stifled a sob, raising her face to the white. For once, there was no awe or reverence in her eyes, just hard, judgmental reproach.
"You didn't have to," she whispered. "I locked the gutter-born bastard's mind away. It's done. You didn't have to."
The white flicked its tail, spattering her face with Cirrus's blood before letting out an impatient growl. Kathleen's eyes clamped shut, and she shuddered in pain, Cirrus realizing she was being subjected to more punishment. When it ended, she let out a low, rasping moan, taking a few seconds to master herself, before once again fixing her gaze on Cirrus, the red coals of her eyes now dimmed with grief.
"I will miss you, dearest General," she said, pressing another kiss to his lips, before rising and moving away.
Dust rose and Cirrus felt a hard gust of wind, seeing the white ascend into the sky with Kathleen on its back. When they flew out of sight, he continued to stare into an empty blue sky. He could feel the battle raging, share the sight of so many spoiled, compelled by the white to renew their assault, and realized in a flare of guilt that he would actually miss being a general. An inquisitive squawk caused him to slowly turn his head, and he found himself looking into the eyes of a juvenile white, tongue darting over its bared teeth. It gave another squawk and hopped closer. Chapter 52. Lizanne. The hurricane exploded as they headed back to the redoubt. There was no warning, and it had been several minutes since the red had even come close. A sudden burst of flame in the upper rear portion of her envelope, followed by a booming thud as the whole structure blew apart. Then she was gone, just more flaming debris falling into the sea.
"A red must have lit a small fire earlier on,"
Morva opined, face grim as she regarded the fast-fading wreckage.
"Took a while to spread."
Lizanne refused to let her gaze linger on the sight, moving to the rear hatch as they neared the redoubt. A quick survey of the battlefield made for unwelcome news. The second line of trenches had fallen, and Spoiled and Green were mounting a fresh assault on the third. They were met by a blizzard of growler and thumper fire, the ground midway between the second and third trench lines becoming marked by a growing mound of dead. Lizanne discerned a lack of cohesion in the White's forces now. The discipline and tactical organization that had marked their previous assaults had been replaced by a seemingly desperate desire to charge straight at the human defenders, regardless of any weight of firepower they now faced. However, Lizanne took only small comfort from the mounting enemy casualties. A brief glance to the west revealed substantial reinforcements trooping across the plain.
"We must have killed close to half by now," she reasoned. "But they have the blood to spend. We don't."
At her order, the Typhoon's gunners expended what little ammunition they had left as they flew over the battlefield, aiming for the spoiled rushing to join in the assault. It might buy the defenders some small respite. Tekayla closed the throttles as they passed over the walls of the redoubt, turning the aerostat around in preparation for landing.
"It's flying,"
she said, hands pausing on the controls as she peered through the front window. Lizanne moved to her side, seeing the white ascending from the hilltop where it had perched for most of the battle. She turned her gaze to the sky, finding the large black wheeling about over the plain. She quickly injected blue and slipped into the trance, found no sign of clay and slipped out again.
"What are you doing?"
she thought, eyes fixed on the black as it continued a seemingly placid circular glide, apparently oblivious of the white, now dragging itself into the sky with broad sweeps of its huge wings.
"Get us down," she told Tekayla. "We need to rearm."
Upon landing, she ordered fresh swarmers loaded,
and went to find Arbaris. He was engaged in directing the fire of cannon on the western end of the walls, attempting to impede the advance of the mass of spoiled, closing in on the outer trench line. The cannon scored hits with every shell fired, it being impossible to miss, but the spoiled swept on below undaunted. Lazan noticed again how all order had apparently been forgotten, and they appeared possessed by nothing more than an unreasoning desire to throw themselves at the human line.
"Can you hold them?"
she asked, coming to Arbaris' side. One look at the grim resignation on his face was sufficient answer.
"When the ships resumed their bombardment, I thought we might have a chance," he said, nodding at the sea. "But now..."
Lizanne turned, seeing that the Reds had resumed their attack on the fleet. Their strength had been eroded in the first assault, but, judging from the number of burning ships, they were still capable of inflicting substantial damage.
"Is there anything you can do?"
she said. They both knew evacuation was now impossible, and there was no line of retreat from this place.
"I can pull what's left into the redoubt," he said. "Since the enemy seems to have abandoned all rational tactics, it might buy us time."
Lizanne shifted her gaze to the sky above the plain. The white was still flying towards the gently circling black. "At least I know where it's going," she thought.
"Do it,"
she said, turning and running back towards the courtyard. She drew up short, however, at the sight of the Firefly taking off. The small aerostat drifted towards the walls before revving up its engines and flying away. Lizanne stared after it, quickly discerning that it was headed for the hilltop where the white had perched. Turning back to the courtyard, she saw Morva raising her arms in a helpless shrug.
"She took off before I could stop her,"
she called up to Lizanne.
"To Kayla,"
Lizanne realized, gaze snapping back to the Firefly as it flew an unerring course towards the hilltop.
"Gone to keep her promise." "Get on board,"
she shouted, running to the Typhoon and clambering into the gondola. She flung herself into the pilot's seat, restarting the engines and pulling back the levers to angle them towards the ground.
"We've only loaded half the swarmers,"
Morva protested as they took off.
"And the gunners aren't aboard."
"No time,"
Lizanne told her.
"Stand ready at the ignition tube."
She brought the Typhoon to 300 feet, angling the prow at the now distant silhouette of the Firefly, before calling out for Morva to ignite the blood burner. The ground blurred below as the Typhoon shot forward, Lizanne opening the throttle as wide as it would go. They had closed half the distance to the other aerostat when she saw a trio of Reds diving towards it. Lizanne looked out of the port window, seeing the white pass by in the opposite direction. Craning her neck farther, she saw the huge black finally respond to the danger, abandoning its serene glide to angle itself towards the white.
"You already made your choice,"
Lizanne told herself, turning back to the Firefly. There was nothing she could do to prevent whatever was about to befall Claydon Torcreek, but she could still save T'Kayla. The three Reds were less than 50 yards from the Firefly now. T'Kayla had evidently spotted the danger and put the aerostat into a sharp turn. As the Drakes veered towards it, they passed directly in front of the Typhoon. The range was fast diminishing thanks to their speed, bringing the Reds close enough for Lizanne to try her luck with the forward-facing guns. The first two flew through the bullet stream unscathed, but she had the satisfaction of seeing the third twist in a spiral of blood, wings flailing as it plummeted down.
"Hold on!"
she called out, hitting the switch that took the blood burner offline, then reversing the angle of the port engine. The Typhoon hadn't been designed for such sharp maneuvering, the entire craft letting out a metallic howl of protest and shuddering as she wheeled about, bringing the Reds back into Lazanne's sights. She blew the second Red out of the sky with a concentrated burst, then adjusted the craft's angle to take aim at the third. It was considerably larger than the average Red and made an easy target. Bazan let the typhoon settle and pulled the trigger. Nothing happened.
Didn't have time to reload those either,
Morva called out by way of explanation. Lizanne gave voice to some rarely spoken profanity and slammed the port engine back into a vertical angle before reopening the throttles. She drew back the main control lever as the typhoon lurched forward, angling the craft to the left so Morva could fire at the red with her mini growler. This drake, however, proved far more wily than most, folding its wings and slipping beneath the typhoon, the stream of tracer missing by inches. Morva kept firing, tracking the drake as it passed underneath, then letting out a shout of surprise as the beast turned on its back and stabbed its talons into the hull. The mini growler was jerked from Morva's grasp by the impact, the weapon tumbling from the hatch into empty space. She came close to following it, managing to grasp a handhold as her legs swung outside, then screamed as flame enveloped the gondola's exterior. Lizanne injected black and used it to drag Morva inside, setting the automatic controls before leaping from the pilot seat. She let out another blast of black to banish the flames licking at Morva's legs, then lifted her from the gondola's floor as the red's talons stabbed through the thin hull once more. Metal screamed as the talons tore at the hull, slicing open a large rent. Lizanne looked down, finding herself matching gazes with the red and realizing she had seen it before. An impressive scar marred the scales around its eye, left there by Lizanne's exploding bullet. The beast's gaze narrowed in obvious recognition, and it renewed its efforts to tear open the hull, snout poking through and jaws widening. Lizanne threw Morva to the rear of the gondola, cast her gaze around until it alighted on her smoker, and used black to pull it into her hands. She unleashed all her red as she trained the carbine on the red's gaping maw, scorching its eyes and jamming the barrel deep into its throat as the red ball ignited. The bullet must have met the onrushing combustible gas from the beast's gut as it detonated, the explosion sending Lizanne into the gondola's ceiling whilst filling the interior with a thick crimson vapor. Lizanne landed hard next to the rent in the floor, watching the red's talons lose their grip as it tumbled headless towards the earth. Finding it hard to breathe and feeling the onset of unconsciousness, Lizanne pressed her spider's second button, flooding her veins with all her remaining green. A certain grogginess still lingered as she regained her footing and clumsily leapt over the gaping hole in the floor to check on Morva. She was unconscious, but still breathing. The burns visible through the scorched gaps in her overalls were bad, but survivable. She might even walk again, Lizanne thought in bitter self-reproach. Going after Tekayla without properly rearming had been a mistake driven by sentiment, not something any of them could afford at this juncture. She positioned Morva on her side and used the spider on the woman's wrist to inject a full dose of green. Making her way forward, she struggled into the pilot's seat, resuming control and killing their forward speed. Both engines were smoking, but somehow still operational, though she had no notion of how long they might last. She could see the Firefly, several hundred yards off now, angling towards the hilltop. Turning her gaze south, Lizanne saw the black and the white finally come together, both drakes spewing fire at each other as they closed, so the subsequent struggle began in a nova of flame. Lizanne pointed the typhoon at the ball of flame and opened the throttles. Chapter 53. Heilmore. The revolver jerked in his fist, sending a bullet into the head of the green drake charging towards him. It didn't die, however, falling onto its side and continuing to scrabble towards him, claws skittering on the deck boards, until Steelfine stepped forward to bring a fire axe down on the beast's neck, the blow sufficiently powerful to sever the head from the body. The islander reeled back from the explosion of drake blood, teeth gritted in pain as he wiped it from his hands and neck. A challenging hiss snapped Heilmor's gaze to the left, in time to see another green charging towards him across the aft deck. He raised his revolver, finger repeatedly squeezing the trigger, only to hear the dry click of the hammer on an empty chamber. A flurry of shots came from his right, scoring hits on the drake's forelegs and shoulders, sending it into a thrashing halt. Loribeth stepped past Heilmor, stamping a boot to the back of the green's neck, pressing it to the boards before putting her last bullet through its head. A shout of triumph came from the stern, where Lieutenant Sigrol was casting the bodies of two more greens into the sea with the aid of Black, his Corventine shipmates raising their weapons in celebration.
"Reckon that's the last of them, Captain,"
Loribeth said, glancing up from reloading her revolvers. The Superior's decks and upper works were liberally spattered with blood, most of it Drake, but they had suffered casualties of their own. Three of Colonel Kolvetch's marines had been roasted in the first red assault, and one of the gun crews had fallen victim to the greens dropped into their midst. Looking up at the many reds still wheeling about the sky, Heilmor deduced their troubles were far from over.
"Mr. Steelfine," he said.
Steelfine paused in the task of dousing his blood burns with water from a canteen and snapped to attention.
"Sir! Get any wounded below and remuster the riflemen. Have additional ammunition brought up for the guns. I'll be on the bridge." "Very good, sir."
Loribeth followed him as he made his way to the bridge house, finding Skaggerhill and two of the riflemen carefully manhandling a green corpse over the walkway railing.
"Whatever else happens, Captain,"
the harvester grunted as they heaved the beast over.
"All the product soaked into this ship today is sure to make you a wealthy man."
"Everyone will get equal shares in any prize money, Mr. Skaggerhill,"
Heilmor assured him, extending his glass and training it on the shoreline. They were only 2 miles off, but the amount of smoke from so many burning ships made it difficult to gauge the progress of the battle. He could make out numerous flashes indicating a sustained artillery barrage, and even from this distance, the shouts of thousands of people engaged in combat were audible. As to who might be winning, he had no notion at all.
"Drake's ahead, sir!"
Talmont called out. Heilmor found them an instant later, a pack of a dozen or more reds swooping low out of a smoke bank to skim across the waves, heading for the Superior's prow.
"Hard a starboard!"
he barked, Scrimshine spinning the wheel in response. The forward pivot gun fired as the ship heaved to the right, cutting the lead red out of the air with a well-aimed canister shell. The remaining reds split into two groups, wheeling about to assault the Superior from two sides. Heilmor saw the head of one drake jerk as it banked towards the port bow, the beast raising a curtain of water as it tumbled into the sea.
"That's another one for the preacher, I reckon,"
Skaggerhill said. He slotted shells into his shotgun and snapped the breech closed before moving to stand ready in the hatch. Loribeth took up position at the opposite hatch as the riflemen on the upper works commenced firing. The tactic of aiming at the wings paid dividends, two drakes plunging down with shredded wings before they could come close enough to cast their flames at the ship. The cannon on both sides accounted for 3 more, leaving 4 who managed to close the distance. Heilmor saw the pivot gun crew run for cover as a red fanned its wing to hover over the foredeck, fire jetting from its mouth. It managed to send one crewman over the rail in flames before a dark blur streaked into its chest and exploded. Heilmor saw Kriz crouched amidst the smoking debris, another grenade clutched in her hand should she need it. But the drake was unmistakably dead, its open chest cavity leaking gore as it lay across the prow. Heilmor saw Kriz cast the body away, then look up and dive to the side just before a wall of flame covered the bridge house windows. Glass shattered, and fire momentarily filled the bridge, leaving Heilmor on the deck coughing smoke. He heard the double blast of Skaggerhill's shotgun, followed by a chorus of pain-filled profanity. Heilmore wafted smoke and got to his feet, finding Scrimshine frantically beating out the flames on Talmont's jacket.
"Stand aside!"
Heilmore ordered, hefting a full water bucket and dousing the lieutenant with the contents.
"Get back on the wheel!"
Heilmore turned to find Lauriabeth covering Skaggerhill's broad torso with her duster, smoke seeping from beneath the garment as she pressed it down. Heilmore fought down a rising gorge at the stink of charred flesh. The harvester's face was mostly untouched, but as Lauriabeth drew the duster away, it became clear those parts of his chest, not covered by green leather, had received a bone-deep burn. It extended in a ghastly line from his collar to his belly, blackened flesh leaking blood amongst the rising smoke.
"Gas!"
he breathed, voice pitched high with suppressed pain.
"The fucker!"
He made a vague, jerky gesture with the shotgun still clasped in his hands. Heilmore's gaze went to the head of the Red dangling in the hatchway, leaking copious blood onto the deck, its body lying atop the bridge house roof.
"Get that thing over the side!"
Heilmore called out, sending the rifleman of the captain's guard hurrying to comply. He then instructed two of the South Seas Maritime Marines to take Skaggerhill below and administer a full dose of green. He began to suggest Lauriabeth go with him and oversee his care, but one glance at her part-stricken, part-furious visage convinced him to still his tongue. He went out onto the walkway, drawing up short at the sight of a body lying across the railing. Preacher's tall form was bent like a bow, his upturned face staring up at Heilmore, as blank in death as it had been in life. Heilmore could see no burns on the marksman's body, but the blood seeping in a thick torrent from his torso indicated he had fallen victim to a tail strike.
"Preacher!"
Heilmore turned to see Braddon Torcreek climbing down from the main mast. Together he and Heilmore lifted Preacher's body from the railing, laying him down on the walkway.
"It was coming for me,"
the contractor captain said, crouching at Preacher's side and staring into his empty eyes.
"He stepped in front of me."
He shook his head, touching a hand to Preacher's bloody chest.
"Crazy old bastard. Guess he really wanted it to come true."
"Wanted what?" Heilmore asked.
"The seven penitents," Braddon said. "The seer wrote that the most faithful would be the first to die in the travail."
He shifted his gaze to Preacher's long rifle, which lay on the walkway close by.
"If you'll excuse me, Captain,"
he said, moving to retrieve the weapon and jerking the lever to chamber around. He slung the rifle over his shoulder, went to the ladder and began to climb.
"I got business up top."
Heilmore gave Preacher's corpse a final glance, then descended to the main deck, calling for reports. All the Reds had been accounted for, and the fires they birthed contained, though the attack had cost them another 5 casualties besides Preacher. 3 fatal and 2 wounded along with Skaggerhill. One consolation was that the Superior had now drawn close enough to shore for him to gain an appreciation of the course of the battle. He could see cannon and repeating guns firing all along the length of the redoubt, providing cover for a large number of defenders retreating through the main gates close to the beach. The trenches appeared to be completely in the hands of the White's army, spoiled in greens continuing to advance in the face of the intense fire from the walls. In places, they were only yards from the retreating humans, some of whom were fighting a valiant rearguard action.
"Blood-blessed,"
Heilmore concluded, seeing how the greens and spoiled were cast into the air or blasted with heat as they charged at these knots of resistance. Despite their courage, it was clear to him they were about to be overrun. Sheer weight of numbers would tell before long.
"Ship approaching off the starboard bow, sir,"
Talmont reported. Heilmore looked to the north, seeing the smoke part to reveal a familiar shape. The viable opportunity steamed to their front, paddles churning at full auxiliary power, a signal lamp blinking a message in standard protectorate code. Fall in astern. Heilmore read, quickly recognizing the author's hand in what followed. All guns fire to shore. Report for court-martial at close of hostilities. So time hasn't improved his temperament, Heilmore muttered to himself before returning to the bridge. Signal the engine room. Ahead full auxiliary power. Mr. Scrimshine, follow that ship. Under Scrimshine's deft handling, the Superior took up position 20 yards to the stern of the Viable. Heilmore descended to the deck and directed the transfer of guns from the port rail to starboard, Ian Steelfine manhandling one of the pieces into position before hearing an eruption of repeating gunfire from the Viable. The Reds had evidently noticed their approach and determined to prevent it, descending in a dense stream straight for the lead ship. Her repeating guns were putting up a hail of fire, concentrated so that the tracer converged on the leading Reds, blasting Drake after Drake out of the sky.
Load explosive shells!
Heilmore ordered the gunners, tearing his gaze from the unfolding spectacle in the sky. Their mission was to save the army on shore, and the Viable was buying them the time to do it.
Fuses set for airburst!
He focused his gaze on the redoubt, seeing the rear guards breaking in the face of overwhelming odds, the defenders streaming for the gates, which were now in the process of closing.
Aim at the base of the ridge,
he told the gunners, glancing left and right to ensure all guns were loaded and lanyards ready to be pulled.
Fire at will!
The cannons fired almost as one, all 8 guns arrayed on the starboard rail and the forward pivot gun. They were close enough to the shore for Heilmore to judge the fall of shot without use of a glass. Most of the shells were on target, exploding in a line along the steep lower slopes of the ridge to send their deadly rain down on the spoiled and greens, now charging towards the redoubt gates. The effect was immediate, the enemy so close-packed that Heilmore estimated 100 at least had been felled by the first broadside.
Keep firing! He called out. Pour it on, lads!
A loud screech from the direction of the foredeck drew his gaze, in time to see Kriz send another grenade into the midst of a trio of attacking Reds. 2 were killed outright, and the 3rd landed on the prow, managing to cough out some flames before Kriz snapped its neck with black. Heilmore raised his gaze to the Viable, blinking in shock at the sight of her upper works being mobbed by Drakes. They latched themselves onto the railing and superstructure, snapping at the crew or spewing flame into the hatchways. Many of the Viable's fittings were alight, and she began to fall out of line as a loud boom sounded within her hull, a tall column of dark smoke shooting from her stacks a second later. He started forward, intending to order the pivot gun to rake the Viable's deck with canister, but forced himself to a halt.
Not my mission,
he told himself, teeth gritted as he tore his gaze away, turning it to the shore. The Superior fired 3 more broadsides as they passed by the redoubt, each one seeming to cut down more drakes and spoiled than the one before. They lay in mounds beneath the walls and the gates, which Heilmore noted in relief were now firmly shut. Only when satisfied that the attack had been stemmed did he turn his attention back to the Viable. She was listing badly now, one paddle turning feebly whilst the other churned the sea white. Fires raged across her decks, and Heilmore was treated to the dreadful sight of a crewman being torn apart by Reds, 3 of the beasts rending the screaming figure into pieces, which they then cast into the sea, squawking in triumph. Above the screeching drakes and roaring flames, he could hear the crackle of rifle fire and the growl of at least 1 repeating gun. They're still fighting, he realized. His mission was clear. He should turn the Superior about and conduct another barrage of the shoreline to prevent the enemy massing at the gates.
But they're still fighting!
For one of the very few instances in his life, Heilmore was seized by an unwelcome and very palpable sense of indecision. The Viable opportunity, the ship he had commanded from the Battle of the Strait through all the many travails that led them to Lossiemark, was dying before his eyes, and he found he simply couldn't allow it.
"Mr. Steelfine!" he called out. "Ask Lieutenant Siguril to join us on the foredeck, and be sure to bring his grenades. Tell all guns to load canister, and prepare a boarding party."
"Aye, sir!"
The islander turned and began to shout out the requisite orders, then fell silent when Heilmore, seeing a new shape resolving through the smoke a quarter mile off the port bow, said,
"Belay that, number one!"
"Sir?"
The Endeavour emerged from the haze on full bloodburner power, her prow knifing through the sea as she steamed towards the viable. The two guns on the Endeavour's bows blasted out canister as she closed the distance. Heilmore seeing several reds fall from the stricken ship as the metal hail struck home. When she was less than 100 yards off, the Endeavour halted, then reversed her paddles, the sea seeming to boil about her hull as she slowed. It was a maneuver that no sane captain would usually contemplate, but this day was far from usual. Shattered and splintered wood emerged in a cloud from the Endeavour's paddle casements as the force of the water fought the power of the bloodburner. In seconds, the paddles were in tatters, capable of making only about a third of their normal purchase on the sea, but that was more than enough for her captain to perform a rapid turn, presenting her portside guns to the viable. They fired in quick succession, raking the other ship's upper works with canister, and sweeping away at least half the reds still tormenting her. The surviving drakes on the far side of the viable rose as one to meet the new threat, wings blurring as they sought the sky. Heilmore barked out a rapid series of orders to the pivot gun crew. Within seconds they had loaded canister and trained the gun on the space between the viable and the Endeavour.
"Fire!"
Heilmore ordered, as the first reds began to sweep towards the smaller ship, blasting several out of the air. By then the Endeavour had completed another full turn, bringing to bear the as-yet unfired guns on her starboard side. Water rose in tall spouts as drakes careened into the sea, cut down by the broadside, but a dozen or more remained to press home the attack on the Endeavour.
20 degrees to port!
Heilmore shouted towards the bridge, pointing frantically towards the Endeavour. Scrimshine had apparently anticipated the order, given the speed with which the Superior altered course. A pool of smoke had already blossomed around the Endeavour, though Heilmore could hear a cacophony of small arms fire and drake cries. Chris ran towards the prow, her satchel of grenades over her shoulder. At Heilmore's call, Siguril soon joined her, and the two blood-blessed waited, grenades in hand. The smoke cleared as the Superior closed on the Endeavour's position, revealing a ship bathed in fire from stern to bow. Reds were still hovering over her, casting their flames down to add to the inferno. Chris and Siguril let fly with their grenades, launching them with black so fast that they blurred. Within moments, the reds had been blasted out of the air, leaving the Endeavour a flaming wreck.
"Hoses to the port rail!"
Heilmore ordered, though he could see it was pointless. The fires had begun to merge, forming one great conflagration that completely covered the Endeavour above the waterline. Within seconds, the inevitable happened, and her ammunition exploded, tearing her in two. Steam rose as the divided hull capsized, the two sections slipping beneath the roiling sea before the Superior's prow cut through the scene of her demise.
"Sea sister."
He stared at the flotsam passing by the hull, flames still licking at some of it, hearing a distant voice call to him, but suddenly finding himself too weary to respond.
"Captain!"
Steelfine's large hand gripped his shoulder, the islander pointing to something off the port beam. Assuming they were about to face another onslaught of reds, Heilmore straightened his back and raised his gaze. A cluster of figures were struggling in the water 20 yards away, Zenida easily recognizable in the midst of them by virtue of her voice, loud enough to reach his ears.
Are you just going to let us drown?
Unwilling to stop the ship, unless in absolute necessity, Heilmor had Chris and Sigurol haul the survivors aboard, plucking them from the sea with Black and depositing them on the foredeck.
Clever, he said as Anita shook the salt water from her hair. Abandoning ship the moment they pressed home their attack. Lost your ship, but saved your crew.
Not all, she said, face grim. Left 10 behind to burn.
Victory demands a blood price, he told her in Verestian. It was an old saying, one he knew to be beloved of pirates, and was gratified to see it bring a faint smile to her lips.
I would like to make a statement, she said.
And that is? She moved close, pressing a kiss to his lips, brief but far from chaste.
I need to find some product, she said, moving away. I trust you have some left.
Heilmor cast a brief glance around the deck, but it seemed the crew were too preoccupied with hosing away the copious amounts of drake blood from the boards to have noticed. He proceeded swiftly to the bridge, ordering the engines to dead slow, and instructing Scrimshine to bring them about. He had the deckhands play their hoses over the viable as they passed by, although a good portion of the fires seemed to have already been extinguished. Despite this, it was evident the ship was out of this fight, smoke leaking in a dense black cloud from her stacks, and her paddles idled in the water. Seeing a signal lamp blinking atop her bridge, Heilmor recognized the rigid form of Captain Tremaine, working the lamp with one hand, whilst pointing to the shore with the other.
See to your duty, the message read.
Send an acknowledgement, Mr. Talmont, Heilmor said. Then signal the engine room to increase speed to 1/3.
His briefly uplifted spirits plummeted upon clearing the wallowing hulk of the viable, and it was a struggle to keep the dismay from his features as the situation ashore stood revealed. The White's army were boiling up the slopes of the ridge, resembling a huge swarm of ants as they clambered over one another, the bodies forming together to create a ladder of flesh. They fell by the hundred to the defenders on the walls above, massed rifle and repeating guns reaping a terrible toll, but the tide of Drake and Spoiled continued to rise inexorably. Heilmor called down to Steelfine to rig the shells to detonate on impact, and have the guns fire into the base of the massed bodies. Their first pass succeeded in reducing the height of the mass by several yards, blasting grisly red holes into it that seemed to be healed almost instantly. The Superior circled around for another pass, achieving less impressive results. The shells evidently killed a large number of Spoiled and Greens, but the mound continued to grow. Raising his spyglass, he soon saw why. The Spoiled were gathering up the bodies and parts of those killed by the barrage and pushing them back into the mass. They were using the flesh of their fallen as building material. Raising his glass higher, he saw that the top of the mass was now only yards away from cresting the redoubt walls. In desperation, he brought the Superior round again, moving at dead slow to allow a maximum number of broadsides, the guns this time ordered to aim at the top of the mass. This succeeded in reducing its height in some places, but not all, forcing Heilmor to an unwelcome conclusion. We are only one ship, and the ammunition won't last forever. Their stocks of explosive shells were already down to 6 rounds per gun, although they did have copious stacks of canister, but the range was too great for it to be effective. He had only one more maneuver to try, and, although the consequences were obvious, it was either this or just sail away.
Mr. Scrimshine, he said, prepare to steer hard a starboard on my command. Mr. Talmont, spread the word to the crew. Load canister and stand ready to run aground.
He saw in annoyance that Talmont wasn't listening. Instead, the lieutenant had his ear pressed to the crow's nest speaking tube, eyes wide in shock.
Mr. Talmont!
Heilmor snapped, causing the young officer to snap to attention.
Sorry, sir, he said. It's just... Crow's Nest reports ships to the north.
There are ships all over this particular stretch of sea, Lieutenant. Sadly, none of them seem to be in a position to assist us at present.
Beg pardon, sir. Not Verestian ships.
Talman's voice was drowned out by a loud whooshing sound that filled the bridge as something very large passed overhead at considerable speed. He managed to catch sight of the point of impact, the explosion dwarfing the Superior's efforts with a blast that exceeded all the shells they had fired that day. The detonation turned the world white and sent the ship reeling back from the shore, Heilmore feeling a hard, stinging impact to the back of his head before the whiteness turned to black. Chapter 54 Clay.
This is not my body.
He repeated the thought over and over, jerking as he fought the pain.
My body is whole. There is no pain. This is not my body. My body is whole. There is no pain. This is not my body. My body is whole. There is no pain.
He let out a shout as the pain vanished, his shattered spine fusing back together, reforged by sheer effort of will. But though he could exert control over his own mental image, the prison that held him rested in the mind of Kathleen Dewsmine, who at this juncture seemed unlikely to return. Clay got to his feet, eyes roving the featureless iron cube of his cell. Clever or not, he thought, she's still crazy. There has to be a crack somewhere. He scoured the walls, hands tracing over the rough metal, looking for some small fissure in the surface, something he could pry apart. Several minutes of searching produced nothing, but, as he retreated from the walls, grunting in frustration, something scraped beneath his boot. Looking down, he saw it was one of the pictures that had fallen from the mantelpiece above the fire when it transformed. The fireplace was gone now, but this picture remained. Crouching, he picked it up, expecting to find an image of Kathleen in her younger days, or a photostat of her unfortunate parents. Instead, it was a spoiled, wearing a military uniform. The same one from the hilltop, Clay realized, recalling Lazanne's shared memories from recent trances. Cirrus. Guess she must like you to keep your image in her favorite memory. As the thought rose, rich in self-recrimination at allowing himself to be trapped, he saw the image shift in the frame. The deformed face of Cirrus turned, looking out at him in clear recognition. Clay stared back, watching Cirrus's lips move. He brought the picture closer, straining to hear the words.
I'm dying,
Cirrus told him in a strangely matter-of-fact tone. It struck Clay as the voice of a man entirely accepting of his fate. Free of fear or desperation, he almost envied him.
She kept something of me, Cirrus went on. I suppose she wanted to be able to talk sometimes. I suspect she gets very lonely.
Yeah, Clay said. That's too bad. You got anything useful to share?
I don't think so. I had a plan, you see? A grand scheme to free us all, set the spoiled to rebellion and bring down the white. But it was just a childish folly. She knew. The spoiled cannot be freed. Once it takes us, it binds us forever.
No, Clay told him. That ain't right. They were free spoiled once. They helped bring it down before. The picture frame suddenly became hot in Clay's hand. The image of Cirrus emitting a soft glow.
How?
Ain't something to be said. More something to be felt. It was the gift of the Black Drakes. They showed me, and I can show you. The frame grew hotter, the glow brighter. Clay felt Cirrus's thoughts lose their reflective apathy, replaced by a fierce, rage-fueled need.
Do you have it?
He demanded. Clay found the required memory quickly enough, but as this was not his mind, the ability to form it into something he could share was limited. In his own mindscape, he could have refashioned Nelfia's surface. Here, all he had was what he carried with him. He drew his revolver, remolding it into a ball of gunmetal the size of his fist. Concentrating hard, he brought to mind the crystals he had seen in the enclave, and the black crystal Chris retrieved from Crystalline Lake. The ball of grey metal began to change, growing spines, and the hard, dull surface turning to glass. With the crystal complete, Clay summoned the memory Lutheron's ancestors had shared with him. The crystal began to take on a soft glow as Clay poured in the memory.
Here,
Clay told Cirrus, extending the picture towards the floating crystal. The picture frame suddenly became white hot. He dropped it, yelping in pain. Focusing on his singed fingers, he banished the pain and returned the charred tips to their previous state. When he looked again, Cirrus's picture was glowing bright enough to dazzle him. Squinting, he watched as it began to melt the iron floor of the cell, the metal glowing red, then white, before dropping away, creating a wide hole. The picture disappeared into the hole, quickly followed by the crystal, leaving Clay standing over it in indecision.
Well, he thought, preparing to jump. Can't see any other way out of here.
The waking world returned with a jolt, Clay gasping in shock as a heavy buffeting wind came close to dislodging him from Lutheron's back. He grabbed hold of a spine and held on, ears filled with the challenging roar of a drake, but this time it wasn't a red. The white streaked towards them, the roar swallowed by the flames jetting from its mouth. Lutheron banked hard, Clay gripping the spine with both hands as the black stood on a wingtip, deftly avoiding the flames before flaring his wings and pivoting about. The white spread its own wings, wheeling around to hover some 20 yards away, Lutheron following suit. Clay saw that the white was not alone. Kathleen was perched atop its back, staring at him in evident puzzlement. Thought she'd locked me away for good, Clay surmised, reaching into his satchel and drawing out a grenade, but the white attacked before he had a chance to arm it. Lutheron folded his wings and dived as the white surged forward, Clay hearing the snap of its jaws above his head. Lutheron extended his wings and went into a tight turn, opening his jaws to blast out a stream of fire at the white, catching the larger animal in mid-turn. It let out an enraged roar, lashing out with its tail as Lutheron swept closer, the spear point leaving an ugly red scar on the black's neck. Lutheron coughed flame directly into the white's face, momentarily blinding it, before rearing back to lash out with his talons, tearing into the scaled flesh of his opponent. Clay could only hold on as Lutheron pressed his advantage, head stabbing forward to clamp his jaws on the white's neck, blood welling as he bit deep. The white screamed in pain and rage, its own talons slashing at the black, their blood mingling as they tumbled about the sky, Lutheron holding on despite the wounds scoring his hide. There was a sound like a miniature thunderclap, Lutheron's teeth tearing clear of the white's neck as he was propelled backwards. As they were pushed away, Clay caught sight of Kathleen, staring at them in intense concentration as she unleashed a powerful wave of black. The force wave continued, pushing them down towards the earth. Clay glanced over his shoulder to see the plane rushing towards them, and, realizing he had somehow managed to keep hold of the grenade, tugged the arming pin free and used the last vestiges of his black to propel it at Kathleen. The white moved in a blur, tail whipping to intercept the grenade before it could strike its target. The explosion broke Kathleen's concentration, cutting off her stream of black and leaving the white minus the spear point at the end of its tail. The severed tip leaked blood as the white whirled about and went into a steep dive. Lutheron twisted and spread his wings wide, stalling their fall, then sweeping back up into the sky. Clay looked down to see a fire erupting on the plain as the white chased them with its flames. Clay armed another grenade and tossed it over his shoulder, quickly followed by two more, reasoning gravity would provide the required distance. He was rewarded with the sound of three rapid explosions, but a backwards glance revealed the dispiriting sight of the white still laboring in pursuit, albeit with one side of its face blackened and leaking blood. He could feel Lutheron's strength fading, seeing the blood streaming in thick torrents from his many wounds, but still he turned to fight. Drawing in his wings, Lutheron turned over and streaked down to meet the white head-on. Clay met Kathleen's eyes as the drakes sped towards one another, finding them full of hate, but also something more. "She's afraid," he realized, seeing how her eyes widened as the massive black plummeted towards her. "Even the mad can learn to fear." He quickly drew his revolver and began to fire, managing four shots before a wave of black blasted it out of his hand, Clay hearing the snap of breaking bones as it spun away. He ignored the flare of agony and unleashed all his remaining red in a rapid stream. He had the satisfaction of seeing Kathleen's hair take light before the two drakes collided. The impact jarred him loose of Lutheron's back, and the surrounding air turned briefly into fire before he fell clear, trailing smoke as he tumbled towards the ground. The impact came sooner than expected, Clay careening across the earth in a cloud of raised sod before sliding to a halt, stunned and winded. He lay there, dragging air into his lungs and trying to force animation into his limbs, hearing the sweep of very large wings drawing closer. Chapter 55. Cirrus. He returned to his body to find his left hand clamped between the jaws of a juvenile white. He barely felt it, having lost so much blood that sensation was now just a distant thing. His hand gave an involuntary twitch as the juvenile bit down, causing it to open its jaws and hop back with an annoyed hiss. An answering squawk from the right caused Cirrus to turn his head, finding the other juvenile regarding him with its head cocked, yellow eyes blinking in apparent curiosity.
"Wondering why I'm still here," he said in a guttural whisper. "So am I."
The juvenile on the right seemed to take this as some sort of challenge, flaring its wings and lowering itself to pounce, mouth opening wide. There was a sharp percussive crack, and the juvenile was instantly transformed into two separate pieces, the upper half spun away from the lower, turning end over end in a bloody cartwheel. It landed a few feet away from its twitching lower half, jaw snapping in a reflex. The juvenile on Cirrus's left leapt, wings blurring and flame jetting from its mouth, only to be swiftly blasted out of view. Cirrus was curiously unsurprised by the face that looked down on him once his rescuer came into view, a face tense with hate and intent on murder.
"I..."
Cirrus began, finding the words choked by blood. He coughed, trying to clear it, but Takayla didn't seem interested in any statement he might make.
"Shut up,"
she said, shouldering the carbine she carried and reaching down to pull a bone-handle knife from a sheath on her calf.
"I have..."
he tried again, blood gouting from his mouth.
"Shut up, Cirrus!"
She stepped closer and crouched, putting the knife blade to his neck. He saw that she was crying and was pained to have grieved her so.
"I have something to do," he said,
throat finally clear of blood, although he could feel more rushing in. He met her damp eyes, hoping she saw some vestige of who he had once been in the monstrous visage she beheld. He managed to raise his right hand, fingers open and palm extended.
Please, it's very important.
Takela let out a sob as her gaze tracked from his face to the blood welling from the hole in his chest.
You killed Jemiah,
she said, taking a hard, ragged breath.
You killed all those people.
Yes,
he replied, his words punctuated by sharp, rasping breaths, each one he knew bringing him closer to death.
And I have done far worse. Soon I'll die for what I've done. You can kill me if you wish, but first, there is something I have to do for you, for everyone.
Takela closed her eyes tight, another sob escaping her as she withdrew the blade from his neck.
What?
She said, head sagging and voice laden with defeat.
What is it you have to do, Cirrus?
Remember.
He extended his hand to her again.
Will you help me?
She stared at his hand, baffled and appalled in equal measure.
How?
I need to remember what it was to be free.
His vision grew suddenly darker, Takela's face becoming a vague shadow, as if veiled by a curtain of black lace. He felt her take his hand, the first time she had ever done so. It was smooth against his calloused, scaled palm, small but also strong, hardly the hand of a girl. He forced himself to focus on her face, piercing the veil that covered it just for an instant, but it was enough. Once, he had thought her a doll, something so beautiful as to be not quite real. Now she had a small bloody scar on her chin, and another tracing across her brow into her tousled and unkempt hair. Her eyes were red with tears and dark with fatigue, lips pale and drawn back from her teeth in anguish. She was so very real, and he knew she had never been a doll at all. He looked upon a face that possessed only an echo of the girl she had been, a face transforming into the woman she would be. Cirrus closed his eyes, drawing his mind back into himself. The bright shining crystal was waiting, a gift from the contractor Kathleen had imprisoned in her mind. It shone brighter as his purpose found a connection with the memories it held, blossoming out, filling him with its gift. The memory it revealed was strange, but filled with enough visual clues for his archaeologist's mind to divine that he was seeing a moment from the past. A moment which contained a vital piece of information. He watched the memory play out, and summoned Takela's face once more, let it lead him to the moment he had first seen her. It had been some tedious ball his father forced him to attend, trussed into a suit that didn't really fit him, scratching his collar as he concealed himself in the quietest corner of the room. When he saw her, it was like everything else went away, fading into a mist with her at the center, so bright, so utterly captivating. She moved with a peerless grace across the ballroom, gliding into a curtsy as Burgrave Artonin presented her to the Governor General. Her smile was a thing of wonder, and her necklace glittered in the glow of the chandelier as she gave a delighted laugh at the Governor's witticism. But it hadn't been like that. Her smile had in fact been nervous and forced, often veering into a scowl as she scanned the other ladies present with badly concealed disdain. When she danced, it was a clumsy, inelegant spectacle that drew titters from the other guests. Also her necklace, Cirrus saw now, hadn't glittered very much at all. The jewels were glass set into a brass chain. Cirrus discovered later that her father had sold much of her mother's jewelry to fund his expeditions to the interior. He had thought that the many humiliations he endured over the following months